The tough part about a brand new career like this or a brand new industry in this way is that nobody really understands because there's no set definition. So you have to create a lot of definitions in people's minds. And, you know, my parents constantly go, you know, they'll see something online because it'll be kind of a clickbaity title about how much money we make or something. And they'll be like, you don't really make that much, do you? You know, I'm like, well, we did just tell millions of people on the internet, so I hope so.
Cody, I'm obviously a big fan of yours. We've been friends for a long time now, and I've seen you grow. I've seen your influence grow. I've seen the number of businesses in your portfolio grow. It's been so cool to watch. You know, I think the first question that I just want to hit on the head is everybody wants to make a couple million bucks and retire one day, right? They want a clear path to get there. What do you think is the clearest path for anybody to bank a couple million dollars and be able to retire?
There's one word that matters, which is cash flow. And the cash flow that you have, you want to try to get the most cash flow on a continuing basis that compounds and then has an exit multiple. You know, what most of us don't think about is, I think it was Sam Altman who had the great line, which was like the ultimate lie he was sold when he was younger, is that high earning salaries are the key to wealth. And that's not the case. High earning salaries can be part of the key to wealth if you take that and invest it in cash flowing assets over time that continue to compound and that you can potentially exit for some multiple greater than what you earn in 1 year. And so in my belief, the easiest way to do this is whatever you're doing right now for a job to try to figure out either how to get ownership or skin in the game in the company that you're currently working with, to figure out how to get ownership in a similar company to what you're working in now as a side hustle, or to go buy one of those businesses. I actually think startups are not the best way to do this. It's not an I think. It's numerically true that they are not a good way to have a lower risk, high rate return. They're just not. I think it's funny that that's become contentious on the internet and that people think, oh, that's so crazy that you'd go and start this type of small business or start that type of landscaping company or all the things people make fun of. Except the truth is the math maths. And so like have all the feelings you want and make as much fun as you want to about Stanford grads running out from Bain and going and buying HVAC companies and then look at what happens to them if they can stick with it 5 and 10 years. And the answer is that they'll be richer than people who stayed at Bain over the long term.
Yeah, I had the same personal realization. I think I was one of those people, right? I grew up in San Francisco, so I was surrounded by tech startups. That's all I knew. So I spent the first 10 years of my career building tech or tech adjacent businesses. Mm-hmm. I built a venture capital firm. I invested in 100 businesses. And then I learned about private equity. I learned about business buying. And I thought to myself, wait, like I'm playing a totally rigged game. I need to set that aside. Rigged game meaning like, you know, you make a VC investment and 1 out of 10, 1 out of 50 end up being very successful. Mm-hmm. I think that's a game where the deck, kind of the odds are stacked against you. Whereas, you know, if you buy a good HVAC business or maybe even buy a good cash flowing real estate or something like that, your probability of success isn't 1 out of 10. It's not 1 out of 50, right? If you put in the hard work, I don't know what the probability is, but it's over 50%, I'd hope.
I think that's exactly right. We probably should just do a little graph and then we can let people battle the assumptions. But, you know, if you take out any feelings you have on it one way or the other, and you look at the math from a statistical perspective, and I think one of the best books anybody can read of all time is, you know, Statistics for Dummies or, you know, like Statistics 101. Because if you can understand probabilities, you just have a higher likelihood of winning because you mm-hmm. understand that probably you are not a unique genius. Probably you do not have a complete unfair advantage to anybody else. And if you can assume that that is in fact true, then you can take the next step, which is, well, if I am actually probably just as good, just as lucky, and just as hardworking as anybody else, then where is there just a game that has a higher probability of success? Because I don't have to be smarter, better looking, faster than anybody else. I just have to pick a better game. And so I think you're right. If you stack ranked it, you'd say, if I want to have an ability to have an asymmetric upside swing, because I've already made my couple million, yeah, I want to do a tech startup. Yeah, I probably want to play in SaaS, royalties, licensing, hardware. But if I want to make my first couple of million dollars, I probably want to go into something that's been done 100 times, that has a consistent likelihood for success, and that is not something that requires a ton of potential upside and almost guaranteed downside.
Yeah, I want to double click on this idea of game selection and investing in cash flowing businesses a little bit later on. But I want to hear how you got into creating content on the internet, basically. And I really want to hear, like, what was the inflection point that, I guess, turned a switch off in your head and said, hey, this is something that I should really be focusing my attention and focusing my time. We met at Romine's Game Time event. And I do remember some period of time where we had a conversation around, hey, like, this is something that's starting to work for me, right? Creating content on the internet. Should I double down or not? And we did have a conversation about that. So I'm curious, like, what was it for you, and like what set that journey off for you?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think when we met, we were just starting to create things online, and I wasn't sure if I liked it or not. I wasn't sure that I would be successful or not. I felt a certain degree of cringe at the idea of videos about my expertise, at the idea of even calling myself an expert. There were a lot of things that, you know, you're just not used to. I wasn't used to having been in finance for a long period of time. But I do remember a few specific instances. Like, I have a friend that's one of the senior partners at Sequoia. And I remember chatting with him about the fund itself. And at the time, I was fundraising for a private equity company that I was a partner at. And I was like, where are you guys raising your next round of capital? Like, where is it coming from? What's working for you? We had just raised like $150 million fund. I think I was targeting like a $500 million fund after that. And I wasn't sure how to raise that kind of money fast and without wanting to slip my wrists. And so I was talking to him about it. And he was like, cash is a complete commodity. It's a complete commodity. It's absolutely everywhere. And actually, we don't raise at all. In fact, we turn away people who want to invest with us. And I was like, that's wild. What do you mean? He's like, well, in fact, we turn away so many people that we will only allow nonprofits to invest with us. And I remember in that moment, I was like, well, then what is not a commodity? I don't think he used the word attention. I can't remember what the word was, but he said something like, it is attention to our portfolio companies. We can get as much money as we want, but we can't make as many companies as we want successful. Like, that is the issue. And so he was thinking of attention in terms of just new users and maybe PPC. But when I heard that word, I remember thinking, oh, interesting. So we've come into this new type of leverage that is not just capital. And I already know how to raise capital. So what if I knew how to invest, raise capital, and get attention? Then that might be an unfair advantage that I would have versus a, you know, multi-hundred billion dollar fund. And so that was the moment where I really decided that I wasn't going to be scared and intimidated by it. Thank God I did, because it has basically negated any need to raise capital. Because the interesting part about attention on the internet is you have to spend a lot of money, you know this, finding deals. You have to spend a lot of money betting deals. You have to spend a lot of money confirming for people that you are worth partnering with. You have to spend a lot of money analyzing deals. And pretty much all of those get decreased with attention. And so I immediately have trust with the founder, good, bad, or otherwise. They kind of like know what they're getting with me. They'll answer like tweets and DMs much easier if I want to do, you know, something with a company. And we get a massive amount of deal flow. And then I can structure terms intelligently. And they already know kind of the terms that I'm going to ask because I talk about on the internet. And so that was the moment that made all the difference for me.
I think about Sequoia because, again, I grew up in tech land, San Francisco. And Sequoia was like the dominant figure, right? And they are the 800-pound gorilla in the room. And what would happen, what I noticed would happen is when Sequoia invested in your company, either other competitors would pivot and change directions, or it would deter other investors from investing in your competitors. Because they said, Sequoia must know something and they have unlimited capital. They're going to make this company successful. And that was the first time that I considered the idea that it's not just the company that's becoming successful, it's Sequoia that's helping that company create a moat around itself. And what you're talking about is adding audience as a lever to that moat, basically. So when you invest in a company, when you source a business and you put your money into it, now you have this audience where you can generate attention to it and actually create a winner out of something that perhaps wasn't a winner just yet.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, there's a trade-off for everything, right? So the problem with creating content and being online is it's very invasive. It's invasive to your privacy. It's invasive to your company's privacies. You know, I have lots of friends that are public on the internet, as do you. And a lot of our friends have companies that they don't want us to talk about them on the internet, because what does it immediately do? It drives competition. So if I say that I have a car wash that's located in XYZ location and it's doing wild numbers, what ends up happening? Well, somebody in that location goes, oh, interesting. Well, I should start a car wash in this location. And so it's net positive for me, but you have to be really careful to businesses that you talk about online, because not all of them can be accelerated, but almost all of them can be competed with in this space. It's very different from venture capital, where if I create, you know, OpenAI, I can talk about it quite a bit, and that just helps it grow. And it's an immediately moated business in a lot of ways. And so it's easier to compete with. The beauty of these businesses are that just about anybody can get into them if they're willing to deal with the hard work that is running these businesses. And so, you know, you have to be careful about what you talk publicly about, which is, you know, something I try to be cognizant of, but I've, you know, done it badly for sure too.
And when we started this call, you talked about your two pillars of focus now. One is your media accelerated portfolio. The other side is your traditional small businesses. What can you tell me about those two verticals and kind of where you're focusing your attention and how you're making decisions around investing or not investing in a business?
Well, let's see, we have two entities these days. And then inside of one entity, we have two pillars. So we have Contrarian Thinking Capital, which is our venture capital fund, where we invest in infrastructure for boring businesses. So for instance, I have owned a lot of laundromats. And so we invested in a laundromat SaaS company that actually bought one of the SaaS companies that I almost wanted to buy out from underneath me. How do I know that that SaaS company is good? Because we've used it. And so that's obvious. The second company is called Main Street Holding Company. And that's basically my family office and now holding company that I've had for a long time that includes two types of investments. The first one are brick and mortar Main Street businesses. These are things like car washes, garage installation companies, laundromats, et cetera. And then the second is media accelerated companies. And so I think they're totally different businesses. If you are a Main Street business, there are four things that you should care about. You should care about getting more reviews for your business. You should care about your clients in a very particular area knowing about who you are. You should care about ability to attract very localized talent for your business. And you should care about the profitability of the model, the financials, and have I structured the business correctly? But when it comes to advertising, it's all local, it's all referral, it's all review based, and it's all local PPC. A big national attention on a Main Street business is totally unnecessary and in fact counterproductive. Then if you think about a media accelerated company, that would be a company like we have a company called Approachment that we bought. And Approachment, it can service small businesses anywhere across the country. It's a SaaS business. So that business, we need to do a lot of things. We could do social media content. We could do paid search. We could certainly do a focus on reviews and referrals. But what's the most useful thing? Just more eyeballs getting to site at a better conversion on the website. And that lends itself to having a big audience. And so I've had to get smarter on something that I knew nothing about before, which was I always played this Main Street game. Now we have this big audience with a lot of my businesses that it couldn't serve before. And so I think a lot of people these days are like, build a content presence, build a content presence. Then it's like, well, it really depends on what kind of businesses you want to own. If you own a bunch of real estate and you don't raise third-party capital, it's kind of dumb to have a big online presence. But if you have media accelerated businesses, it's actually pretty intelligent.
Earlier you said, and I love that you brought it up, because when we got into this game, we didn't come from a private equity background. We bought some businesses that worked out really nicely, but frankly, those were accidents. Yeah. And then we bought some businesses where we made some huge mistakes, right? And it sounds like this media accelerator portfolio is fairly new for you. Mm-hmm. What learnings or mistakes have you made so far? And what have you identified as your kind of core focus going forward? And maybe folks listening to this can reach out if they have a business that fits that.
I've found this sometimes, you know, you're good at giving advice and then you look back and you say, why didn't I take my own advice on the subject matter? It's how much easier it is to be a loudspeaker than a mirror. And in this instance, with our media accelerated companies, I did two things that I tell people not to do, which is there's already a barbell in investing that has existed with minds much more brilliant than any of us for a long time. And that is private equity, which is control and almost complete ownership, versus venture capital, which is no control and very minority ownership. Those two things have existed for a long time, and there's a reason why. Because anything in the middle is what I call the messy middle, which is actually the worst place to be. The worst place to be is non-control, kind of material position, but you can't affect the outcome. And so I did that with two companies in the Media Accelerated company. And all of a sudden, I didn't own most of it. I'm talking about it out loud. And this company is meaningful for me, but not meaningful enough where I can make decisions. And so that is something that I would never do again. Stay out of the messy middle. Either own the whole thing or have control over it, or don't, and don't spend a bunch of time on it and hope that you're good at betting as opposed to growing. Two very different things. And so now we don't play in the middle between the two of those. The second thing is what I think everybody does the first time that they get into a sector, which is go too small. And I understand why people go too small in the beginning. They buy jobs, not businesses. And I did that in some ways, is because it's scary. But what most people don't realize is the difference between $1 million to $3 million EBITDA business or $5 or $10 million EBITDA business is really just how much cash do you have to make sure that you don't die. And that's like really from 1 to 5 to 10, you could say that's the material difference. Slightly more complex, but you just have more runway. And so I bought too small of businesses with an idea that our media arm would grow it. And I wouldn't do that again. I would either start the thing off entirely or I would buy a much bigger business.
So is your preference now, I mean, you've built this massive audience, this large newsletter list of people that could be potential buyers for your services. So is your preference to own the majority? Because it feels like you're creating so much value for these businesses that why would you want to own like 5 or 10% of a business where you're going to create so much value?
Yeah, I think I will do that if it's in the venture capital fund, in which case we will help them on a group basis, but we're not going to get our hands dirty in the business and we will not be the force function for growth, which is important for venture capital. Like venture capitalists always talk about all this value add. And what you end up finding when you invest in small businesses is you end up giving all the value and time to the businesses that end up having the lowest return, and the ones that become outsized don't need your help. They're motoring. Like they might need little things one off here and there, but you could barely call that value add. And so, so on the Media Accelerated side, yes, we either want to own control majority of companies, or we want the company to be quite big that we come into. And so it's already running, it's already growing, and it really just needs fuel to the fire. And we come in with like a very prescriptive mandate. So like, for instance, I'm looking at a nationwide franchise company right now that I really like. For the first time in looking at franchises, I really like this model. There's a lot of reputational risk if you do a franchise model, because if franchisees fail, it's heartbreaking. It also looks terrible. And so I'm really thoughtful on it, but this business has been around for 10 years. It's growing quite nicely, but we could add a ton of fuel to the fire and I could have a meaningful stake from somebody who needs nothing except more distribution. It's already working. It's already running.
And in this case, you would be investing in the franchisor and become a partner at the franchisor level.
That's right.
That's right. I love the franchisor model for people who have a large distribution advantage, right? Because if it's a good business that's already working, its biggest challenge is always just more eyeballs, yeah, right? Just opening more doors.
That's exactly right.
So you can come in and really pull that lever for them. I think it can transform their business, certainly.
Yeah. Well, and I think the other part that's really important about franchise businesses is you really have to get enough people that you can properly select only the people who have the highest likelihood of winning. And so to me, it's not always when you have a franchise model, when I've invested in them before, there's two things that really go wrong. One is that the model doesn't work very well or has a high failure rate just inherently. And the second is that the model actually works pretty well, but they don't have enough curation on the people that come in. And so, you know, you can have an incredible mousetrap, but you know, if the mousetrap is too tiny, then it's not going to work, right? And so that's the other thing I'm really, really specific about is, do franchisors really understand who the right avatar is for them to win? And are they willing to say no to a lot of money upfront? And I think a lot of the big franchisors, the problem is they just want the fees, then they take back the territory, they resell it to the next guy, and that you don't want to have happen.
Definitely. It is a beautiful business model when it works. It's kind of like software, right? You're basically paying for a license and a brand, and you're getting fees off of that. So if it works, it works great. If it doesn't work, it's a pretty pretty hard business. I've definitely seen that before too. Meaning at the franchisor level, if it's not really taking off, I can see it being a pretty difficult business.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, what I've learned over the last 3 years of talking to a bunch of people about buying businesses is that, you know, there are kind of three types of people. You're a type of person who, one, you like the idea of going out and running your own business or having your own business, but you probably are not going to execute on it. You're going to think about it for a long, long time. And just for whatever reason, that will never be what you end up actually doing. Some people rudely call them entrepreneur. I don't think that's right. But, you know, somebody who likes the idea, probably never going to take action at scale. Then you have the type of person who really wants to do this. And no matter what, it's just a matter of time. They're going to execute. This is the type of person that you can't stop, but you can accelerate. We try to find those both in our portfolio companies and in our communities to help accelerate the people that are like, I'm doing this no matter what, but can I do it faster, better, cheaper, make more money, et cetera? Cool. And then you've got this third model, which I'm realizing more and more, which is somebody who is going to do it, but would like a little bit more handholding. And wants freedom and ownership, but actually wants a lot of guardrails, wants to bowl with bumper lanes. And that's actually a beautiful model too. There's nothing better about this risk it all, throw it all out person in the middle than the bumper rails. And the bumper rail person actually probably does pretty well with franchise because they're like, I can work hard and get it done, but I don't exactly know how to do this. And I would like somebody to help me along every step of the way. And I'm willing to give up some percentage of economics in order to do that. And I think those are the three types. And it's important to try to find something that serves everybody if we actually do believe our mission, which is creating 1 million people who are financially free and a nation of owners. So you can be an owner that just owns part of a company while staying W-2. You can be an owner that owns an entire company in type 2. And you can be an owner that owns part of a franchise or a model that has partial ownership in type 3.
I really identify with that. When I started my first business, it was a little education business on the internet. And I felt like I was innovating across every variable, right? We had to create our own brand. We had to build our own website. We had to go out and do the marketing and the sales. And it was very, very difficult because I just didn't know anything about entrepreneurship at the time. But I did have a desire to succeed and I worked really hard at it. And reflecting back on it, I do wish that I had some more structure to it, right? Like doing a franchise business as my first business would have actually been a great idea because they would handle 80% of the business, right? And I could just go in and work and kind of execute the playbook. And through that, I would learn what it looks like to have a good business and a bad business, what a P&L looks like. It took me like years to understand what a balance sheet was. I think it took me 10 years to understand what a balance sheet was. It's embarrassing.
I don't believe that.
I
think you're right, really quick. All I would double tap on that is I think when you're looking at franchises, one of the most important things is exactly what you said. They're another gateway drug business, which is why I talk about laundromats so much and boring businesses in general, is because they're easy to understand. And franchises have that exact same thing. So you can go in and your first business doesn't have to be your last business. But I think a lot of people get that really confused. They're like, why would you give up a job to go run a business that only makes $100,000 a year for the pain? And that's valid. But also, you might want to do that because, in fact, it's teaching you how to run a business while you're still making money, as opposed to an MBA where you theoretically learn how to run a business, but you pay a ton for it.
Yeah, you definitely learn the most in the trenches doing it yourself. So I agree that I like that like framework of the gateway drug to business, right? Like you just need a way to get started. You need a way to get comfortable with this risk and like these challenges and franchises. Great way to do it, or laundromat might be a great way to do it as well. I want to talk a little bit about the concept we brought up earlier, which is game selection. It's something that I think a lot about, because that first business that I was telling you about, like, it always felt like I was swimming upstream, basically. So we started this little software basically for course delivery for professors, right? I was a student. That's kind of all I knew. I wanted to put my materials on the internet so I could access them on my laptop. And what I learned pretty quickly was that selling to universities was hard. Selling to professors was hard. Building the software was hard. And then once we did succeed at that, getting students to pay for stuff was really hard. So I remember talking to a family friend who's an investor, and I asked him, like, man, this is so difficult. Like, I asked him such a simple question, like, are there some businesses that are easier than others? And he thought about it for a bit, and he basically said, look, like, in some businesses, you're always swimming upstream. And then in some businesses, the market is pulling you and it feels like you're swimming downstream. So yes, like, maybe it's not easier, but overall, it's a better journey. And I'm curious, like, what could you teach people, or what have you observed about picking the right game to be in?
If you're ever in concern about what to do next, always go back to the math. And that's the thing I keep telling our team again. And I do it. I think that's why we're pretty good at content, actually. If you could validate, like, one reason why we might be good at it, if you think we are in fact good at it, I drive it like I do a financial model. We analyze every piece of content that we go out. Sometimes you'll see us delete pieces of content because they didn't perform very well, and we repackage them and repurpose them in another way. We track week over week growth, month over month growth. We have KPIs for every single member of the team that's here with us. We have those KPIs tied to our overarching growth metric. There's a scoreboard, just like there is in every company, from two perspectives, which is a revenue perspective and then also a growth perspective of subscribers. And so, you know, just like financial analysis, the same thing applies to content analysis. I think anybody who doesn't do that or tells you they don't do that is lying. And, like, there's very few creators, maybe you could get away with it if you're like a Casey Neistat, for instance, that just throw stuff out there kind of willy-nilly. And I hazard a guess that that man is obsessed with the back end of YouTube Studio anyway. And so I actually think creators are probably much more quantitative than people give them credit for. And they're pretty focused on human behavior, which are two things you really have to be good at in finance too. You've got to figure out, will this human perform the way that I think that they're going to, and why? And then how can I create constraints in order for them to perform that way in a more specific manner? And so, with businesses, it's the same thing. I just go to the math and I go, okay, if I want to allocate $1 million, where do I think that that $1 million will be most likely to go out and bring back friends? And I typically look at things over a 10-year period. I'm not very good at market speculation. I don't play that game at all. And so I just look at, over, like, rolling 10-year periods, what industries worked out the best and why. And then we have a model that we put everything in, with things like, you know, what sort of multiple do these businesses have on average when we sell them? What sort of margin is reasonable in this business? What's the failure rate of these businesses? And then how much capital do we have to put up front before we can get to our break-even period? But there's a couple, like, if they want the quick hits, it's like, the math tells you, don't invest in restaurants or any sort of food-related business. Retail's really, really hard, so probably don't invest in retail. There's huge variability in e-commerce and anything related to Amazon, fulfilled by Amazon stores. There is huge variance in anything related to consulting or service-based businesses. You know this too, really easy to start, really hard to continue to grow. And then the last one that I'm really thoughtful are real estate heavy businesses. So things like hotels, for instance. Well, actually, you just bought one, didn't you?
That's right. Yeah. Just last week.
Hotels, I hate this business because, well, I don't want to have any business that requires 24/7 attention typically. And so depending on how you structure it, it could be okay. I have a lot of friends that have made money on it, but you have to be good, not just between the hours of 8 and 5, which is hard enough, but then you've got to find people to be good between the whole 24-hour cycle. And I do like that for the most part, my businesses probably aren't breaking while I'm sleeping. And I used to run businesses in Europe, and that wasn't the case. So I would wake up in the morning, and because we had businesses on a different time zone, I'd be in the fucking fire. And just personally, I don't like that. And so part of this is just knowing what you want to run too. If you're an incredible hotelier, and like you and Xavier are, you love community, you love gathering people, you believe in the power of place, then a hotel might be your mission as opposed to just pure profit.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about your team structure, right? Like kind of selfishly, I want to understand the content side. So we'll come back to that in a second. But let's, you know, you've bought a series of businesses. You bought a laundromat business, which you mentioned you sold, and you are going to be buying more companies. Do you have like a president, an operator? Is there somebody like who's ultimately getting the phone call when things are breaking or there's like a staff that has an issue? How is that all happening day to day?
Yeah, we have a big team now. So just on the portfolio and finance side, for instance, we have a CIO, a chief investment officer that runs that business. We have an outsourced CFO, so we don't have him 100% of the time, who actually runs that business as well. We have an associate that helps us analyze the deals and make sure that we do portfolio modeling on them. We have an analyst who's junior and helps us source more of the deals and roll them up the chain. We have a an attorney now that's full time because there's always something going on with contracts and deals, and it can become really expensive if you do that one off consistently. We have a portfolio manager over both portfolios, Contrarian Thinking Capital and Main Street Holding Company. You know him, Chris. And then we have a what else do we? Oh, and then we have a couple growth people. So we have somebody who's focused on, you know, growth hacking and coming up with creative ways to help the companies grow. We have somebody that's focused on pure paid marketing to help the companies grow in that way. And then we have somebody that's more focused on, you know, what I would call like Main Street mechanisms. So referrals, reviews, et cetera. And that's just the portfolio side.
Wow, that is a big team. So your marketing person, your growth person, they are going into each individual business, parachuting in and seeing which growth levers can we turn. Is that right?
Yep. Okay. That's exactly right. Yeah. And this is new. The marketing and growth component is something that we've done over the past year. If you would have asked me a year ago, I would have said we buy companies like bonds. We buy a company that, you know, kind of consistently grows 3-4% per year. We might optimize that slightly, but we're like clipping coupons, serving the community, nothing crazy. But if we're going to have a media accelerated portfolio, we need to actually accelerate the companies. And so this portion is something that we've grown of late. And then since we have two companies in there that were really big investments, at least for me personally, I have huge goals with those. So those guys will have their hands full.
What do you do if one of the general managers or CEOs, I don't know what you call them, of the businesses aren't working out for you guys? Like who gets the first call? Is that Chris? And then what has happened in the past if that's the case?
Yeah, this is the worst. You know, the thing that they don't tell you about holding companies and portfolio companies, you know this too. Like Tony Robbins had a line that's always stuck with me, which is, he's like, I have 50,000 employees. At any given moment, including this one right now, somebody is royally fucking something up.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have to get used to that idea if you want to play at this level. And so keep, you know, like Victoria Beckham says, or David Beckham says, be honest about the fact that this is like what you want to choose to do. And so at any given time, there's mayhem and chaos. Historically, I used to take all of this. So, you know, this started as a family office and a personal holding company. And so I was the one handling all of these issues. Now that's not the case. Now it's going to our CIO or it's going to the head of the portfolio for them to deal with it. You know, but in the past, there's been instances. I mean, if I have a couple rules, it's one, be really careful when you do stuff for friends, except if you have no expectation at all about getting any money back. Two, everything changes when money is involved with somebody and they haven't lost money before. So like, it's really useful to speak previously with like, when have you lost money before? Let me talk to the person that you lost money with. And so, you know, you and I have both had companies that had a lot of volatility in them. And so we're probably pretty used to this game. Like, okay, it didn't work out. We're going to move this. We're not that emotional. But for most people, what they do is they panic and then they lie and then they cheat and then they steal. And so unfortunately, I've just seen the game so many times that it sucks when things aren't working out for you. And it takes a really special person to come forward, be clean about that, and be against their own self-interest. And so previously, you know, I've definitely, I've been lied to, I've been stolen from, I've been all those things. But it all came down to me choosing an operator, probably based on like early friendship signals as opposed to actual competency. I like to keep my friends friends. I invest in things like I invested in yours passively. I'm sure, you know, you guys are pros. I'm sure it'll work out great. But if it doesn't, I don't actually care. You know, it's not going to break the bank. It's, it doesn't have my name associated on it. So I really have a separation of Cody and state, right? And if we're not going to have that, then we better be best friends. And I better have seen you at your worst a few times. Otherwise, I've just seen people go nuts. And the bigger you get content-wise, the more reputation risk you have because, you know, people will say crazy things. Because they have nothing to lose and you do.
Mm. Wow, that's actually a really interesting thing that I haven't considered before. I will say that doing this now for a while, given the scale of our organization, we have different companies with different leaders. When people ask me, what is the most important quality that you look for? It's not the answer that most people expect. It's really integrity, right? Like I want to know that like, it's not that like you're great or you're horrible. I just want to know that I can trust you. You know, at the end of the day, like you may have done a great job with the company or you may have done a poor job with the company, but as long as you were honest, you protected the reputation of the company, you took good care of people around you, and you came to us with bad news first, honestly, then everything works out. You know, our relationship's going to work out. Business is a marathon, right? Like even if this business isn't a huge success that you're running, 10 years from now, if you were honest and had high integrity and worked hard, it's most likely that we're going to work again. I've just seen it over and over again. I've been in the game for long enough.
You nailed it. Because it's not just about like who you partner with investment-wise. If people are like, wow, this isn't that useful. I'm not running a portfolio company. It's who you partner with as a co-founder. It's who you partner with as your, you know, significant other. It's the people that you hire on your team. And there's really only a couple things you want to ask them. In my opinion, you want to go through their history and you want a history of winning. And so everybody can have some fails, but like multiple fails are a red flag that's usually associated with that person and not what happened to them. So that was the first thing that I messed up before. Two failed businesses before, everybody else's fault. I should have said, don't partner with this person. Also, what did they do historically? Finance, it's very easy. You can't really exist in finance for like 10 or 15 years if you suck and you lose people money. Like it's too transparent. You know, you can survive one cycle, but you probably can't survive two. And so you want to know that they've been through a bull run. And I partnered with somebody who like was a professional, like the job literally was kind of being a professional liar. And I was like, this is cool. So smart. And the way it communicates is great, you know, and I wasn't thinking it through. And then the third thing that I would look back on again is like, I want to talk to your ex-partners, you know, and it's okay for not all of them to have something good to say. Surely many of mine do not. But like for the most part, I want, you know, if you went to our portfolio and you talked to the other individuals from the companies that we've exited, they would say, she was a fair trader. She actually gave me the company back at this point. You know, she invested this capital. We did well together. Like it's pretty easy to do a little due diligence on partnership historically, but sometimes I haven't done that. It's bit me.
Yeah. I'm a crazy person when it comes to reference calls. I'll call 10, 12, 15 people if we're going to go into a new partnership together, both references that the person gives me and I'll back channel as well. And the other thing, which is kind of a riff on what you just brought up, is I've noticed that the best leaders that we hire, they come with two or three other incredible leaders, right? They kind of say, hey, I know we're not ready for this today, but whenever we're ready, I want to bring in my old CFO, my old head of operations. And then when you talk to those people and then you talk to their references, you triangulate that, wow, they're actually really great. And they're willing to pick up their families and their work and their job and actually come and follow this person. And that's a pretty incredible sign, you know?
It's so funny. We're just talking about this yesterday. We're hiring a position here at one of the companies for head of marketing. And I was like, there's always one question I ask every time. And I forgot yesterday because I had to cut it a little short. And that is, you know, if we were to hire you, who would you bring with you, both employees and vendors, if anybody? And so I sort of say that if anybody, as like a, it doesn't matter.
Sure.
But it matters. Right. It is so important. If you're going to be the head of something and you have nobody you want to bring with you, huge red flag. And that probably means you're not able to lead anybody. Whereas one of the CEOs we just hired, he came from a big marketplace. And day one, he brought three people with him that all said they would work for free until their non-compete was done in like 3 months. And so, you know, that I think is what you want to look for if you're going to partner with a leader.
Yeah. Wow. That's really, really interesting. And I think useful for anybody who's hiring. This last question, I just want to spend a couple of minutes on this very selfishly. I'm curious, what is your content team structure? Because, you know, I recognize the value of building up my audience, right? I've started doing it. I've been posting on Twitter and LinkedIn in my newsletter. I wouldn't say I'm like naturally a content creator, but I recognize the value and I do enjoy writing the newsletter. Like, I think it's a fun way to hone my thoughts and like kind of like force myself to learn new things every single week. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about your content team structure. And then I'm curious to hear you riff on what, where you think I should kind of hire or spend my attention.
The biggest difference in content and everything else is that content takes breathing room. And so if you're going to create, you have to step into the side of your brain that is creative and unmanageable and wild and does not create well within the hours of, you know, 8 to 9 that you have perfectly scheduled. And that was the hardest part for me with content. And I still struggle with it because we run all these businesses. But if you are going to create content, you have to allow the muse to come and go as she does. And I think a lot of people don't do that. And so we pack our lives with things and we expect to write something profound in the, you know, paragraph breaks. That's actually quite hard to do. You need a clean page actually for the profound. And so the first thing I would say is you have to structure a business around yourself, which is really weird. And the opposite of how we were taught as servant leaders building businesses. It was we build a business and a team to serve the business. And in this, in some ways, you have to build a business to serve the muse. And so that has been really hard for me to do, but it's something I might recommend for you, is it's really hard to go from, you guys know when you come home from work and like you're in business mode. I don't know if this happens to you, but you're like, you're firing somebody or you're yelling at something about somebody not getting done, or you're behind on your projections and your tone is like this. You're like, well, we need to do this, this, and this, and I don't have time. So please handle that tomorrow. Can you email that to me? Okay, great. And then you walk into the house. You're like, hey, babe, how's it going? And then you walk and it's like, no, you have to break. You have to take a pause before you enter the door and you switch frames, right? And you're like, hey, how are you? How was your day? And you don't give that same energy to your wife as you do your business, right? Because that wouldn't be very fair to her, but it's hard. And I like to think about content creation that way too. It's like, I can't go in there and go, I shall write the top 10 things that I, you know, that's not how that works. So that's first. And the second thing that I think a lot of people don't do right now, but is necessary for next level creation, is it has to be great. Like, what you create these days has a very high bar for excellence because the ability to create has come down so far where everybody can. And so if you're not going to make it exceptional, the difference between an 8 and a 10 is really important these days, I think. And especially when you already have a bit of a reputation, making sure that you can preserve that in some way. In the past, I used to say, if it's kind of cringy, whatever, let it go. And now I actually think the opposite of that. I think a little bit more thoughtfully on it. And then with team structure, I get why people model it after celebrities in some way. Like, I get why there's like an agent. There's sort of like, you almost need a CEO typically might have like a chief of staff, right? And they might also have a COO, or they might have a CIO, or they might have a chief counsel. And they're sort of like the two, I don't know enough about sports, but like they're the two linebackers in front of the quarterback, right? And they like make sure nobody comes through. And I think you need that a lot more in the content business. So for me, that's my head of content who like blocks a lot on his side and everybody in the content reports into him. And then my COO, and my COO blocks all the logistical stuff. And I think start at the top. A big mistake would be go and hire like a VA or a ghostwriter or whatever. Don't do that. Always hire your highest level executor first and let them fill in the team as you go. Be my two cents.
That's awesome. I am starting to look for a head of content. Mm. What experience set do you think I'm looking for? Like, what is their background? What are they bringing to the table? How do I know that they're kind of in my higher box?
You can always teach aptitude. You can't teach attitude first. You know that. And so I would say content is a treadmill. And so you need somebody who has the ability to have almost investment banker-like work ethic, in my opinion, because you're posting all the time and there's a lot of stuff going wrong. And when you post content with your name on it, you cannot have somebody who doesn't respond to you when they post something on a platform that you can't get into for some reason, and they've made a financial claim. And you're like, get this down right now, right? And so I do think you need to hire for attitude more than aptitude if you can choose anything. And then the second would be, you can either teach somebody on your dime or steal 10,000 hours. And so in my opinion, I want to look at the models of people that I admire, maybe even a model or two ahead of them, and think, can I hire from a team that's already in existence, but maybe on the decline? And so for some instances there, it's all, you know, it'd be very hard to steal from Mr. Beast's team or Logan Paul's team. But is there like a tier creator right below them where they used to be growing really fast? Now they're kind of not, you know, they were in the game at some point in an area that was really interesting, crypto, blockchain, Web3. But now it's not that interesting. And so they might want to swap lanes because the content remains, or let's see, the rails remain the same, but the type of engine that goes on it might change. Mm-hmm. Those are the two things I would look for.
That's really interesting. Is it important that they have their own audience, that they've proven that they can do it for themselves, or is that less of a thing?
Audience is a double-edged sword. So if they have done it for themselves, you have to make sure that they don't want to continue to do it for themselves and not work for you. And so I actually don't care about that. I just want to know, I want to be able to check that the person has actually executed on the mission that I am going to task them with, and that that mission was successful. And so when you're hiring for a new role, I almost always require some sort of project work up front. I'll pay for it, but I want to see, how are you going to write this specific brief? How are you going to film this specific video? What are some ideas you have for me currently if I'm going to grow my content business? Can you write those out to me? I'll pay you $500 for the hour to do it, or $500 for 2 hours to do it. And this will make sure, by the way, that you don't make the most important life change that you really can make besides marriage, which is career change, and it doesn't work out. Because I beat myself up every time we hire somebody and it doesn't work out. That's partly my fault, if not a big part my fault. And so I lead a lot with that. Like, let's do a little project work, not for you to do free work, I'm going to pay you, but because what if you come here and you aren't good at this or you hate it, and we could have solved that by 2 hours of work.
Really interesting. And then what are some examples of what the COO is doing in your day-to-day?
Well, the COO runs, in this instance, runs multiple aspects of my company. But when I think about every vision, every business has two things, right? Somebody who comes up with the ideas and somebody who executes on the ideas. And there are lots of different names for those two things. But you really cannot find a business in which you have only one of those two. You can find businesses that aren't very successful that only have one of those two. And so you need to determine first, what are you? Are you the visionary? Are you the integrator or executor? And I imagine for the most part, people who are creating content are the visionary or idea person, and they're going to need their executor. And so in any operational role, the idea is, anything that is not my highest and best use, I am going to hand off to my number two, who's my COO. And so your number two, even if your number two is a VA in this instance, will be to take anything off your hands that you do not think is something that you are uniquely skilled in the world to do. So in my instance, I'm uniquely skilled in the world in coming up with ideas for content that are taking something that might be complex and simplifying it. I'm pretty good at that. And likely partnerships and deals, finding them and seeing something in them that nobody else does, and then selling them the dream. So like those three things I'm probably best in the world at, and I might be one of the best in the world at selling people the dream on why to come to the company. So my job should be content creation, talent confirmation, not recruitment, like convert the talent. Also for me to, come up with, let's call it like deal sourcing, not closing. And like, it might just be those three. And anything that's not those three, that's going to go to my COO, and he needs to fill a team that's able to execute on all those.
Got it. Yeah, I love that perspective. That's something that I've been reflecting quite a bit on. It's like, what is my zone of genius, and how can I fill people in to take care of all the other pieces where I'm not the highest leverage? So I'm glad to see that you've already implemented that team around you. Cody, this has been great.
Do you have a COO right now?
What's that?
Do you have a COO right now?
I don't have a COO.
Do you have a chief of staff?
I don't have a chief of staff either.
I might consider, I think hiring scale to me, depending on how much cash you have, always starts with like VA or assistant, chief of staff, COO. And so depending on how much you guys want to spend, I would go for one of those three, and you can keep them as your business scales. So like, it's not like you have to drop them as you get to the next level. If I was you, I'd probably start with either a chief of staff or a COO. And their job is really to be, again, they're probably that linebacker that's kind of like clearing the way for you to actually execute on the big things. And then the hardest part will be, which you'll be good at it, but maybe for people listening, the hardest part is relentlessly saying no and setting expectations of what you're good at or not. For instance, this happened today. My head of content's like, we want to hire this person. We're going to bring them, on board, and they'll be there, remote if they can't be there in person for the shoots and whatever. And I had to say, no, they need to be here on site for the shoot. I do not want to play a game of telephone. I'm kind of coming into our one shoot day a week, firing because I got stuff on either end of them related to the business. And so they need to be there like a director on stage the whole time. And he's like, well, I think we could maybe do that, but maybe we can't. And I said, this is a hard line. You either find somebody that does this job or you come here and do it. And that is one of the hardest parts, I think, with content, because it feels selfish. Like, it feels selfish to like, well, I could probably do this. Well, that, like, I could, and you're like, no, you can't, because the muse cannot be distracted. And so that's what I would push on you. And I'm happy to look at anybody that you're contemplating for the role and tell you if I think that profile looks reasonable for you or not.
Yeah. My order of hiring right now is head of content. Maybe if anyone's listening, they can reach out. I want a head of acquisitions, right? Somebody to lead the acquisition side of the business, and then a head of asset management. Those are the three kind of senior roles that I'm looking for. And we don't hire a lot at Enduring. We have a tiny, tiny holding company. There's just four of us, two investors, and then a head of legal and a head of finance. So this is kind of a big deal for us to go from, really like two senior people to five senior people.
That's amazing. Congratulations. That's a big, exciting push. I actually think there's nothing more amazing. Like, we bought an office here. I'm sitting in it right now. We resigned it. We redesigned it. It's really cool to be in. It feels kind of nice. And I think in this day and age where we all went remote, where we've all worked in corporate jobs before that felt soul sucking, there is no greater joy than being with a high performing team all rowing in the same direction on something that hasn't quite been done before. It's really, really cool. So if anybody gets that opportunity, I think that would be a cool one.
Yeah. What's interesting about the career that you're creating is that you're charting a brand new path, right? For like decades or hundreds of years, people have been plumbers, right? People have been electricians, people have been dentists, but you are creating this whole career around building an audience and being an investor. And if I really think about it, this really hasn't existed until maybe the last like 5 years, 10 years at most. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm curious, like, do your parents understand what you do for work?
No, not really. I'm going to see my mother. My parents and I are very close. But I think, to the first Indians go the first arrows, right? And so I think the tough part about a brand new career like this or a brand new industry in this way is that nobody really understands, because there's no set definition. So you have to create a lot of definitions in people's minds. And, my parents constantly go, they'll see something online because it'll be kind of a clickbaity title about how much money we make or something. And they'll be like, you don't really make that much, do you? I'm like, well, we did just tell millions of people on the internet, so I hope so. They definitely, they think it's really cool what we're building, but it's very hard. My mother was a 30-year special education teacher. My dad now works for me in one of the businesses. like, it's just a different mentality when you run a business. They're more concerned with how much you pay in all these people. Like, are they doing their work for how much money? And then when they find out how much money somebody makes, they're like, oh God, you know? And so it's really an open mindset versus a more static mindset, but I wouldn't be able to be so open if I didn't stand on a pretty closed foundation. And so I appreciate it.
Yeah. Amen. Well, I also think what you've built is incredible. Cody, I look up to you. You're awesome. I really appreciate you taking time to chat with me today.
It was such a pleasure.
And that's it for this week's episode of Boring Businesses. I'm your host, Sieva Kaczynski. Thank you for watching or listening today. Any resources we mentioned during the show, we'll make sure to link in the show notes or below the video. If you're listening to this on Apple or Spotify, please leave me a review. It really helps me learn and it allows other people to discover the podcast as well. Thanks again, and make sure you hit the subscribe or follow button if you haven't already. I'll see you next time.